This is a podcast that watches Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 49 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today's a kind of unusual episode. Instead of interviewing a really great creative or a director or someone involved in that side of the advertising business, I suddenly had this idea last week to talk to a client. I mean, partly because I don't think we as creatives are exposed enough to clients, and therefore they become a little bit of a mystery, and the business side becomes a bit of a mystery. I'm sure plenty of you do get that exposure, but for those of you who don't, I think you might want a bit of insight, because I think that there's kind of a cliche here whereby you get sort of secondhand feedback that the client didn't like this or wants the logo bigger or hasn't bought this ad or whatever. What are they thinking? Why are they giving you that feedback? What happened? What's going on in the room? But what's going on in their heads generally? What do they think of the agency? How's that going? So I managed to find this client without actually that much effort. Yay. And he is an automotive client for a big brand at a big and good agency in the UK. So I think I've said this on my blog, but he knows what good advertising is. This isn't just someone who buys small space press ads for a shed company. He's really there at the top end of what's going on. So have a listen. It's actually, interestingly, I was in conversation with another potential guest this week, and he said, what do you think are the most interesting episodes you've done? And I said, well, one of them actually is this one I've done this week with a client, because I've actually learned more than in some of the other ones, only because I already live in the world of creativity and writing and stuff. And in some cases, I was kind of going over great ads that I already knew and finding out the stories behind them, which was great and very insightful and interesting. Thanks very much to everyone who did that. But this is a whole different world for me in terms of the real minutiae that a client has to go through on a day-to-day basis. One thing you might be heartened by is the fact that there's a real overall sense that it's almost like client and agency versus all the other people back at where the client is, the product people or the money people or whatever. The client, this client at least, seems to give an impression that he's on our side in a lot of ways. And when he's doing things that aren't really good advertising as we see it, it's often because there are other people back at the ranch that are making that happen. Anyway, I thought it was fascinating. Please enjoy. Oh, our anonymous client. I can't say who he is. So he is just the client. Here we go. Thanks for joining us. Interesting, anonymous client person. It's very kind of you.
Not at all.
Great. So I guess I wonder if it might help if you gave us some background into how you became a client. And I'm going to use that word client. I mean, from the agency side, we tend to just go the client, a client, whatever, and we might get into the nuance of that a little bit later on. But why and how are you a client?
Really good question. I've been client side, around about 25 years since I left university. Funnily enough, I applied to JWT and was told that my degree was not from a posh enough uni. and so ended up immediately going client side. So then went on a graduate training scheme, and the then marketing director gave me some advice that I took to heart, really. She said, try sort of product marketing, research, comms, a few areas before specializing. Work out what you really enjoy, and even the stuff that you don't enjoy will help your learning process. And just fell in love with comms, really. Some of my formative years are in the 80s, which I consider the golden age of advertising anyway. So the John Webster era. So, like many people that I come across in agencies, believed I was sort of born to do this as a line of work, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, if you were there in the 80s, you must have seen the landscape change quite a lot. What are the big changes you think have really happened?
I think it's interesting how creative and media agencies have moved apart and then moved closer together. I think as their margins get squeezed, everyone's fighting the battle over over all things sort of related to content, you know, because typically there are out-of-scope fees, you know. Lots of client businesses have squeezed agencies. It's interesting, particularly on the media side, how there's been this trend towards cost matrix-based pitching.
What is cost matrix-based pitching for those of us who are a bit, ignorant?
Here's an indicative media plan. Give us your bid. What would you buy this media plan for? And then give us the reach and frequency numbers to go behind it. And effectively, the contract is awarded on the basis. That's massively oversimplifying it, but it's just squeezed margins. And as the likes of sort of Tag, etc., have become clients' best friends, they've in turn squeezed creative agency margins. So there's this sort of no man's land that everyone's sort of scrabbling around in now, which is, sort of content, where everybody wants a piece of the action to earn some extra income. So I suppose that's one of the most interesting things. Obviously, you've had the advent of digital, and it's interesting that lots of agencies scrabble to set up digital teams, digital departments. And agencies now, big agencies who describe themselves as integrated, still have separate teams for digital. I personally, that's one of my biggest bugbears, the fact that actually I had to talk to different planners or different account men or account women, you know, in different disciplines. As far as I'm concerned, we're in the business of marketing, and, you know, we all need to be looking at our audience and working out what channels they use and adjusting our message accordingly rather than demarcating ourselves by on and offline.
Okay, that's really. I mean, I think you've put out like about a million things into my head just then in terms of what you've just spoken about. But just as one thing, and the last thing you spoke about, this separation of disciplines and the fact that we kind of gained another giant swathe of different media options, I guess, about 15 years ago, and you know more. More of them have appeared in the sort of 10 or 15 years since. How has that affected what you've done on a day-to-day basis? Because I totally get that you're saying that agencies have said, hey, we do everything now, and all agencies need to say that and want to say that. But what's your experience as a client in terms of how that change happened and how effective it was and how much, I don't know, how much bullshit you were served about it?
A lot of bullshit. Still a lot of bullshit gets served about it. I think the most interesting thing was the opportunity to join up very different KPIs to try and crack the difficult nut between linking sales numbers with things like brand consideration.
Yeah.
So when you can lay out a variety of KPIs along the kind of the McKinsey path to purchase, I think that's a really interesting place to be because you can look at trends, you can have much more meaningful sort of econometric or attribution models that help you with your planning task as well as look backwards and see what worked. That's been a massive opportunity, but I think some of the kind of the core principles of that John Webster era still hold true. You really need a big idea at the heart of your campaign effort. Regardless of on and offline, and you really need to know what your brand stands for. I think the thing that the digital age has made very real is the fact that the brands get caught out very quickly if they're not authentic, and as a result of that, I think you need to be very sharp on revisiting your brand positioning. As well as your KPI mix and ultimately making sure that your ideas are big enough to span all channels.
Yeah, I think I'm going to end up going like backwards and forwards in different areas because even just in that answer, there's a whole bunch of different things. So you have your KPIs, and I'm just going to tell anyone who's not. I'm sure my audience is not in any way ignorant. You're all completely au fait that means key performance indicators. But I'm just going to make it clear. But I think that we, as people who work on the agency side, go,
So we've put this ad out. What difference has it actually made, and how are you measuring it, and what are you holding an agency to in terms of the performance? Because if I wanted to buy, say, an Audi or something like that, you know, I might do it because of an ad I saw 10 years ago, 15 years ago, an article I read in the papers yesterday, all sorts of touch points. So what are you holding the agency accountable for in terms of your actual sales?
What I'm holding the agency accountable for is kind of standing alongside me in the trenches when stakeholders get really challenging around your campaigns not working, because I'm sure that's going to be a familiar theme that everyone's experienced very soon into the launch of a new campaign. You get expectations are sky high because you've done a great job of selling into the business, and if results aren't immediately coming in, all of a sudden salespeople go, it's not working. So I think what I would hold an agency accountable for is really helping me bring together those disparate numbers across the purchase funnel and look for trends. So everything from early buying signals like increases in branded search terms, increases in kind of web traffic, you know, relevant hits on right content on the website, through to things like dwell time as well, and then helping me kind of tie those together with stuff that might be going on in the market that might be a distraction. Newspaper readership fluctuates with the weather, for example. So I'm just looking for help in piecing that all together and some shared accountability. At times it does feel like what you're tasking your agency colleagues with is just helping you collate some ammunition to go back to challenging stakeholders.
And who are those challenging stakeholders out of interest? I mean, I think I was going to ask, like, who's looking over your shoulder at what works and what doesn't? Because we know that you've got a kind of you're being tasked to do something, and do you have to answer to the head of the actual company, or is it your boss, or how does that work?
With many brands, particularly international brands, you have stakeholders in different territories as well, but. Most important stakeholders are typically have sales in their job title. But in the automotive world, you also get franchise owners, you know, who own the dealership. They don't, have sophisticated means of measuring footfall, measuring inquiries. So lots of your data is kind of a proxy for footfall. So
right.
Web hits, dwell time, etc., are a measure of interest that you're generating in the marketplace, and it's bringing that all of that together, but also in a digestible way so that non-marketing people can understand it.
Yeah, because I think I've heard stories of, like, you know, we showed the ad to like some conference of all the showroom people, or like you say, the franchise owners, or whoever it happens to be. Is that true? Does that really happen? And does it matter what they really think of your ad? And are they, do you have to take interest in what they're saying, even though obviously they don't do your job? So their ability to evaluate and assess a commercial, is it just about making them happy on that day? Or is it really something you have to take into quite deep consideration?
Much more the latter. You have to instill confidence, both in terms of kind of the fact that the campaign holds together, it makes sense. You know, talking through an understandable version of the strategy, understanding why the creative looks as it does and why the channel mix looks as it does, but also then giving them a sense of how important the mother brand, if you like, is taking this launch or this campaign. How serious they are about it, because they in turn know where to focus their effort, because typically speaking in the automotive world, marketing budgets support new car sales, but they have other challenges around, you know, used vehicles, getting, you know, current owners into service their vehicles, etc. They need to achieve many targets themselves, but giving them confidence that the biggest target, the new car sales target, for example, is going to be looked after. There will be some momentum created for any new vehicle, some awareness for it, so that when they do talk to drivers of a smaller, same brand, model, they're confident enough to say, well, have you seen this ad? Are you aware of this new vehicle? I think it could be relevant for you for these reasons.
Right. Okay. That's interesting, and also because I think what you were saying before about having stakeholders that have to have an interest in the ad that you're choosing, it now feels like there's so much. There are so many parts to an idea, and there are so many people getting involved in an idea. And if you're an international piece of business, there are so many countries that have to take in that piece of idea. And I've worked internationally, and you not only have different cultural kind of touch points that may not be covered by an execution, or may not be covered as powerfully as you think by an execution, but there are ideas that just don't translate. So who gets to choose an overall idea? And do you think that in trying to please that many people, you end up with a lowest common denominator that maybe doesn't hit the bullseye for anyone?
That's certainly the risk, because you do get a lot of politics come into play when you're selling ideas across borders, regardless of category. You do need to really distill your argument to as simple and accessible terms as possible. Whilst you're potentially talking to marketing stakeholders, you've kind of got to treat them a bit like the sales colleagues and just making things as easy and digestible as possible. And I think that would bring me to another one of my sort of pet bugbears, if you like, as a client. Oftentimes you get agency responses, particularly if you've tasked agencies with working together as an integrated team. You get documents that are hundreds of slides long. That's no use to me whatsoever. That to me demonstrates poor thought rather than depth of thought. I think everything needs to be distilled. It's a bit like, you read about in the agency press around the best creative briefs are really brief, and it's all about distillation. That's true as well when a client stakeholder takes a campaign strategy, to their stakeholders in another market. That's absolutely what they need to have in their pocket, and they need to be so able to communicate the. They need to understand the nuance to be able to communicate that, but they don't necessarily want 10 slides about it.
I
don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, it totally makes sense, and I think if you've got the other thing I was going to ask in those terms is, you have all these different people, who all want a slice of the pie. And I remember I've been in the business long enough to know that when we actually got together with the sort of direct marketing arm for the same client, and we were supposed to be presenting United Front, and the DM guys all wanted to do a TV ad. So we're sort of having to defend our turf, going, no, we're the TV guys. You're the guys who do whatever DM was back in that time. And like you're saying, you've got companies like Tag, you've got the media company, you've got the production company, you've got the agency, you've got the other agency, you've got the other agency, and they all want to grab different bits of what people are doing. So do you find that level of conflict actually doesn't serve you, or does it create a level of competition that gets everyone at the top of their game?
It's difficult, because it's not always visible to the client. I think the most important thing is the debate. I think debate is helpful, particularly if it's about interrogating the strength of an idea and potentially taking it to a greater depth. I think it's unhelpful when one agency, independent of another, comes to sell an idea and shows an example of how that might be executed in a channel that they're not responsible for. That sort of thing is unhelpful. I think briefing, the DM team on the idea and giving them the opportunity to come up with some food for thought and contribute to that initial sale, I think that's much more important.
Yeah, it feels like to me when I was in that situation, it's like we could all have a go at each other's things and all like contribute in that way. And I think it happens actually in departments in the agency as well, because like the planners might think, hang on, that idea is better than that one, or if you change that line a bit, maybe that would be good. And then the creatives get defensive and go, hang on, that's our thing. And in fact, having looked at your brief, your proposition's too long and blah, 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 blah. And so I get that the kind of the froth of the kind of, people wanting to improve things or wanting to be, skeptical or critical about what they're being given can help. But I think in this day and age, the financial strictures are obviously much, much tighter. So does that mean people are calling you up behind each other's backs and going, we actually did this idea, you know, maybe it's better than the other guys. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that, I mean, that does happen. Again, I don't think it's helpful. I think the most helpful thing is because ideas potentially need to be executed touch points now, I think the most helpful thing is that ideas are shared as early as possible when there is confidence in place. And I appreciate there's a balance to be struck there. You sell an idea in too early, you know, it could get shot down simply because it's not brought to life enough for someone seeing it afresh. But on the other hand, I think the earlier it's shared around the broader agency table, the more everybody has the opportunity to give some consideration as to how it can be executed in their world. Because again, when it comes back to 100 plus page PowerPoint decks, the worst thing from the client's perspective is a Frankenstein's monster of 80 slides on the above the line, and then right at the end of, you know, a meeting, potentially a presentation, suddenly the DM guys get up to present their two slides, and then, you know, and this is how we bring it to life on the website, and, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. That, you know, that's really not helpful. It's when there is this sort of collaborative effort, it's so much more helpful. So, and again, makes it such a more powerful sale when you're taking it to a stakeholder who's potentially, you're talking to them in their second language.
Yeah. It must have been a really interesting process for you to, or a learning curve to have gone from, if you're saying that there was the 80s and there were maybe press, poster, TV and radio, and that was kind of it, to where we are now, where there are, you know, another 100 kind of things that you have to assess. How is your learning curve been in those terms? And do you have internal training? Is there someone looking out for the fact that you might not be au fait with all the terminology of experiential versus, you know, programmatic or whatever it happens to be? How has that been for you?
It's something you really need to make time for. I actually, commuting to work sort of on a train, I try to use things like dead time, like, you know, on a train, for example, just to read up on what's going on in the industry. So I'm an active Twitter user.
Yeah.
And where interesting case studies are shared, I like to share those with, you know, my agency colleagues as much as they like to share them with me. I also think it's important for clients to have direct dialogue with media owners, not to have any kind of commercial conversations that might make the media agency uncomfortable, but just to hear what other clients in other unrelated, you know, sectors are having success with or testing, and how they're evaluating those tests. I think that's really important. And, you know, for me, for example, when I think about businesses that have embraced digital rather than are catching up with their customer, whilst I'm working in automotive, which is a very kind of, you know, male world, it's interesting what's going on in the cosmetics industry, where that kind of that digital technology is really being brought to life at point of sale. So the risk of a digital brand springing up and kind of cutting off their traditional sales channel is reduced, because that's certainly taking place in the automotive world, you know, where you've got websites now that will quote for a vehicle purchase, you know, rather than you know, customers going into dealerships, because again, it's a touch point that the automotive brands, they don't own it, so they can't really influence what takes place there directly. You know, it has to be done through big sessions to sell in campaigns, etc. You're typically dealing with a head of business rather than the individual guys that are dealing with customers. And you've got big issues like 4 in 10 women, you know, if you believe some of the data sources, they delegate the task of researching and buying a car to a boyfriend or a father. Yeah. because they don't like being patronized by car salesmen. So it's a real challenge, and I think you do have to look around for inspiration in other sectors and see how they're responding to the same, you know, broadly the same challenge.
Yeah, that's really interesting because we're often told as creatives, it's like if you're having trouble with coming up with an ad, think of it as being done by a different team or in a different area. What would you do? So it's interesting that you have the same kind of perspective on what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know the guy's a copywriter, but you know, Dave Trott is somebody that I actively follow on Twitter, and I think it's really interesting reading his column in Campaign and thinking about life as a client as well. You know, thinking about how you might come up with a fresh take on an old problem. Mm. And again, you know, that can only come through collaboration and people suggesting ideas that then get built on.
Sure. I've written a note down here that says, digital, is it bollocks? And I know I'm not at all saying all digital is bollocks at all. What I'm referring to is there was a thing this year where a client, like he cut whatever, a huge amount from his digital, it might be just programmatic, buy, and he didn't see any...
Unilever, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the Unilever, and he didn't see any difference in his sales. So do you look at something like that and go, oh, shit, are we actually making a difference with the things we're doing? Or do you kind of go, well, that's just specific to him and it doesn't affect me?
Well, I suppose I'm in quite a lucky position in that you can't directly buy from an ad in my market. But I do think that the banner has been seen as a particular format that serves a particular purpose. And I think actually things like mobile banners, for example, they can be a gateway to an experience, immersive experience with a brand. Mm-hmm. And again, that comes back to being really confident about having a suite of measures of success, suite of KPIs, rather than just kind of click-through rates, for example. Because I still feel there's a role for, you know, kind of content that's not necessarily on your home site. So, again, clicks and visits aren't necessarily the measure of success for banner ads, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really interesting. And it's something that's a real bugbear of mine is this whole area of intrusion and privacy and surveillance and things like that. I wrote quite a long blog post, or maybe it was Medium, like last week or the week before, and the whole thing about how we're being spied on all the time, generally in the name of advertising. You know, people are taking all their data from everything that we're doing, and I believe listening to what we're saying, through our phones. Maybe I'm being paranoid, but I've had some sort of experience that's backed that up. Do you feel like as an advertiser that ultimately that comes down to your own demands, and do you feel responsible for any of that at all?
Potentially. I mean, I totally agree. I think if you think about the business of a bank, it's to siphon money from its customers and give it to the shareholders.
Yeah.
And when you look at a business like Facebook, ultimately they're doing the same thing. They're siphoning data from people using that platform and they're selling it to advertisers without really making that whole murky world transparent. Mm. So when people are interacting with these little applications, what sort of person are you? Not necessarily thinking about all of that data that's being gathered as part of this front end is going to, you know, come back at me in terms of ads. I don't necessarily feel responsible for it as a client. I feel really concerned about it. I don't agree with that sort of model of disruption. I think it comes back to that point that actually you need to be really clear what your brand stands for and what your big idea is that's being executed across all those different touch points. You kind of, you know, particularly with Facebook, I think that they're a really interesting encourage brands to go and develop their own pages, invest in them, and then build fan bases, and then turned around and said, oh, by the way, nobody's seeing these messages you're posting on your wall. You need to pay to promote them to this fan base that you've effectively rented. I think it's really interesting how Facebook have kind of got away with that, and I'm just wondering whether we're starting now to see the tide turning in relation to this whole Russia investigation and now Brexit investigation in the UK with where are these ads coming from, etc. The whole world of fake news. I think it's a really interesting time reputationally for Facebook, and I wonder whether some of those particular pigeons are going to come home to roost in 2018.
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird one, isn't it? Because I think Facebook almost wants to claim responsibility and not responsibility at the same time. Because if they say it's nothing to do with us, so, you know, it's not our problem, it's down to other things, then effectively they're saying our platform isn't as effective as we're trying to convince you that it is. But if they do say, yeah, Facebook works really brilliantly, you can reach 126 million people with 5,000 people in a bot farm in Moscow, then they're saying, well, you know, that's the root of the corruption. So I wonder if they're going to, you know, be able to balance that as a, yeah, we are really effective, actually, no, we're not, as a way of doing things as a company. But,
Yeah, they can't have it both ways. And to turn around and suggest it had no influence, I think is ridiculous.
Yeah, I think one of the things that from agency or creative departments is a subject that comes up constantly with clients is budgets. And as we touched on earlier on, they're kind of shrinking and margins are shrinking and people are trying to, you know, find ways of making the most of the money that they do have. And, of course, if you were back in the day making a TV ads and radio ads and press and posters and that was all your thing, that was okay. But now it has to be spread between so many different touch points and so many different platforms and so many different routes. Do you feel like that's been a problem for, say, creating impact and in the conversations you have with agencies and saying, well, you know, we've got to design a website, we've got to get people to the website, we've got to have a TV ad, we've got to have a bunch of posters, whatever. How do you reconcile those demands with the amount of money and the range it's all going to kind of encompass?
It's a really interesting point, particularly in the automotive world, because as you say, the budgets do get spread thin, you know, because you've got potentially agency fees, et cetera, coming out of that as well. And it can mean that sales colleagues, you know, particularly people in those dealerships that we were talking about earlier, they just don't see the campaign, they don't experience it because they're not in the right places, particularly if you're selling a car that's competing with the Fiat 500 with a very young, very female audience. You know, those old guys might not see the campaign at all.
Yeah.
So it's a real challenge. I think that in turn places a need on provision of sort of in-situ imagery from the media agency to be able to demonstrate the visibility and give confidence to those who might be having those concerns. But equally, that's why, you know, I would sort of want to use things like econometric modelling, et cetera, as well to help me just bring together the disparate data sources and join the dots. So, yeah, it's definitely a real challenge. And in particular, if your colleague from another market says, actually, we want you to run this bit of TV in the UK and you've got no intention of running TV because it's not appropriate for your campaign. That's, you know, that's a real challenge, and politics can come into it. It's not necessarily an objective debate.
Yeah, I imagine there's a huge amount of kind of wiggle room about, you know, if you take money from this thing and put it in that thing, is it really going to increase sales or brand awareness that much? It must be really difficult because you can't, without a time machine, you can't prove that was definitely the right decision to make. You've just got to go on, you know, what you've got to go on, and that must take some hard conversations.
Yeah, and particularly when you read things like, you know, Byron Sharp's How Brands Grow, it gets frustrating as a client to read that and think, you know, this guy's living in an uber simple world, you know, I'd like to have him walk a mile in my shoes sort of thing. It's a real challenge, particularly when everybody around the table comes up with fantastic ways of executing a central sort of idea and you just think, actually, we're at risk of spending, you know, all of our budget on production and nothing on media. So it's a continual balancing act.
Yeah, do you think that proportion has changed as well recently? Because, I mean, I remember Russell Davis, when he was the planner on Honda, would say we should be reaching a point where we're spending no money on media, I guess because the ads would be viral or whatever, and all our money therefore on production, making some spectacular ad that gets shown all over the place. But it's not as simple as that, because you can make a really amazing ad for not that much money. I think something like Dumb Ways to Die wouldn't be anywhere near as expensive as perhaps your average, you know, global car commercial, but the kind of memorability of it would be great too. So how do you assess whether And I think I'd use movies as an example here as well. Like, you know, there are sort of normal everyday movies that cost, say, $20-30 million put up against Justice League, and they're being seen as often, or maybe not as often, but, you know, one costs $200 million to make, one costs $30 million to make. How do you evaluate whether production money is being spent as effectively as it could be in relation to media?
Really, really interesting challenge. Again, it's something you kind of you need to consider on a case by case basis. We have a rule of thumb. We don't really like spending more than, say, 20% of the overall campaign spend on production. You know, sometimes with a new model, you'd want to develop a lot of content for places like YouTube, etc., or you know, seed that out with influencers. But it's a real problem because there are competing brands with much, much deeper pockets. And I like to try and focus on outthinking the competition rather than outshouting them.
Yeah.
So if that does mean that you need to push the production ratio a little bit further, I think there are times for that. But again, you kind of need to work together very much as a team with the agency colleagues to help build that case, because there's going to be a stakeholder somewhere who's going to want some convincing about that.
Absolutely. I guess we've gone into the sort of more modern, sophisticated bit, but I feel as a creative, I'm going to represent my department a little bit here in perhaps a slightly broader fashion, because there's the whole cliche of make the logo bigger. And there are reasons why, you know, I'm just going to take that as one example of, you know, say creative demands. And, you know, we say make the logo smaller so it doesn't look like an ad, so people don't turn the page, whatever. The client would often say, no, make logo bigger. I paid for this ad. I want people to know that it's from me and blah, blah, blah. And you want to know that it is an ad and all this kind of stuff. Do you find those conversations difficult / frustrating / invigorating, inspiring? How do you approach them as someone who's in theory more, I guess, left brain as it's seen from the outside? You go, clients are people who have like normal businessman type jobs, and creatives are creatively artistic-y kind of people. So do you find that when those conversations come up, you're kind of put into a slightly difficult position in terms of how your opinion is expressed?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, have no doubt that the client is on your side in that scenario. And it may be that the feedback is, I mean, you know, that sounds like purely subjective feedback, which is a real frustration for everybody anyway. But it may be that that's coming from a stakeholder who has little experience of the subject matter, and potentially is just, you know, is a bit risk averse. I think you do get in businesses, you do get marketing directors, for example, who've been promoted into the job from another division.
Right.
So they haven't necessarily got a lot of background to sort of draw upon in those sort of situations. But oftentimes with big brands, there will be kind of corporate guidelines which will be agreed in collaboration with the agency, which will dictate logo sizes, that sort of thing. But I think it comes down to everybody involved understanding where the idea is and where the execution is, and then trying very hard to maintain the integrity of the core idea through that sort of subjective feedback. Again, that'd be a bugbear of mine as a client, seeing a fantastic idea die needlessly. All I would say to your creative colleagues is have no doubt your day-to-day stakeholder, you know, your client, day-to-day client, is very much on your side in that scenario.
Well, I think that's really interesting because, you know, we sort of see client as one sort of amorphous blob, unless we have client contact, which I think is really, really important. And I think more creatives should have it, because then you realize you're talking to an actual person with intelligence and opinions and things like that. But often you get it reported back and they say the client didn't want to go with this, or the client and whatever. But I think the more time we actually spend talking to clients, the better. And I think also one-to-one human interaction is by far the best way to communicate anyway.
I totally agree, yeah. And I think the same is true up front with the briefing.
Yeah.
you know, you need a written brief, and for any big campaign, you need a face-to-face to accompany that. I think it just comes, hopefully it comes down to sort of earned, you know, and mutual trust. If the client can get involved in front of the creative team and have that conversation around what precisely is the problem, it affords them the opportunity to come up with a creative solution to fixing it. You know, and I totally agree. I think the more discussion and, you know, ideally long-term discussion, the more there's kind of trust built up. And that therefore, then when those ridiculous sort of bits of feedback come through, it's because it really has to get actioned, and all sort of debate has been, you know, things have been pushed as far as possible internally.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say the agency you have connection with is known to be a good agency. So I guess that there is a reservoir of good work and a knowledge about good work that you guys probably operate under. So that might make the system a bit smoother, because I'm sure there are a lot of clients out there who do things your way, and there are probably clients out there that it's not quite as important. But what I think would be interesting to get onto a little bit is how much you care about how massive, inverted commas, creative the idea is. You know, I know we've been talking a little bit about how good ideas are and how big ideas are and things like that, but assessing a good ad and whether it's, you know, an award-winning-y kind of thing, and I guess awards and effectiveness should go hand in hand, how do you feel about, you know, whether creative people think an ad is good or not, and does that really enter into your thinking about it?
Yeah, I think within my perception within the agency is that there are sort of three parties. Again, there are sort of tensions on, you know, within different departments on both sides. I think the creative team want to win awards, potentially go to Cannes to, you know, as well. I think, you know, kind of the account team, the client services team are probably much closer to the business agenda and closer to, therefore, to the business problem. And then you've kind of got the planner maybe who's got a more objective perspective and is trying to reconcile the creatives and the account team. But, you know, creativity for me is interesting. I think it's really important. It's what you want from your agencies. You know, fresh thinking, you know, perhaps generation of fresh insight, I think is one dimension of that. And that's certainly something that I look for in a pitch as opposed to well-polished creative work, you know, because you can work on the execution. It's the kind of the creativity of the core or idea that's really critical. When it comes to awards, I'm really not interested in creative awards personally. It's effectiveness awards that I'm much more interested in. And if we have the results, you know, from our campaign under our belt, you know, why not gloat about it? Because it was hard work for all involved. But I do get upset if a big chunk of the agency disappears to go to Cannes and they're clearly not working on your account when they're there because they're big, you know, it's somebody else's award submission. You do get agencies that are very, very focused on writing awards and very good at it. And then perhaps some of the smaller clients will suffer as a result of that. That's a perception of mine as a client.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, and I'm also interested in you talking about idea versus execution, because when an idea is presented to you, obviously, especially if we're in the creative department, we live within a world where we think we're trained to have an idea of what the finished article is going to be like. And obviously, that finished article is different in literally everyone's head. You know, even in a creative team, the copywriter and the art director are thinking about two different things when they're thinking about the finished ad. And it won't be like that anyway, because it's got to go through a CD, it's got to go through a client, it's got to go through a director, it's got to then be edited and music and all that kind of stuff. So it's never going to be what it is exactly in your head. How easy is it for you to assess a so-called big or good idea and be aware that when it gets executed, it's still going to be as good as you're hoping it will be at the beginning?
Yeah, it's really tricky. I think the client, you know, needs to ask the right sort of questions and really demonstrate a bit of imagination at the same time. But equally, we'll be looking for the agency to be bringing to life, you know, bringing along a mood board or something to kind of evoke that those pictures in the mind. I kind of liken it to going to get a tattoo, really. You want to ask the right questions up front to make sure everyone is on the same page. Because otherwise, you're going to walk out potentially quite upset and stuck with something.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned pitches a couple of questions ago, or one or two. So in a pitch situation, I don't know, from our point of view, it's almost like a client gets to sort of sit at a feasty kind of table and go, well, I'll choose from these six delicious menus and you guys can all tap dance for me a little bit because, you know, you want this piece of business. And, you know, I'm the guy who gets to make the decision, or one of the guys who gets to make the decision about whether you get it or not. How is your perspective and your thought process going in that? And is it a collaboration where you meet a few times before the pitch to kind of make sure they're on the right path? Or do you want them to just like see their original thinking and see what their gut tells them about what the pitch answer might be?
Yeah, I think it's really important that there's dialogue in place. I think you need to talk through the brief, certainly talk through any questions in response to the brief. And then I think a sort of a tissue stroke chemistry meeting is important before the big presentation. There's nothing more disappointing than getting into the room and then seeing an agency present something that's taken them many evenings and weekends to put together that's just completely wrong. when I'm in the seat on the day, I really want a good understanding of the business problem. And I suppose the emphasis really is on the planners involved at that stage. Ideally, they will have dug up some fresh insight that gives a fresh perspective on potentially an old problem. But then also how that is translated. How does the planning team work with the creative team? Again, are they on the same page to the earlier kind of discussion? Are they of one mind? And then the kind of the execution, if you like, is less of a concern. It's much more around how the execution is arrived at.
So yeah, I mean, I think there's a sort of old saw in the industry that you don't really ever run the pitch work, and is that because the other things are more important, and you can always change and kind of look at the idea differently after you've awarded the business?
Yes, yeah. Certainly, that's been my experience of pitches. You know, the other things can be polished later. And again, it may be that there's brand guidelines in place that just need to be presented and talked through that will help with that. But certainly, you're looking for chemistry. You are looking for clarity of thought. You're looking for a deep understanding of the brand and its sector, not necessarily, you know, a track record of experience in that sector, but certainly an understanding of it, as well as then, you know, a team of people presenting stuff that they believe in that you can ultimately work with. There's nothing more frustrating than awarding an agency an account after a pitch and then finding out you're going to work with a completely different set of people. You know, you want to see the people that you will be working with. And again, you know, the client is ignorant of the fact that actually the people putting that pitch together might actually be full-time on other clients. And the business is going to be suffering from a lack of attention. But so at the same time, you're ignorant of that, but it's in nobody's interest that there's loads of wasted work. So you definitely want to be having dialogue in place before the big day.
Yeah, and when it comes to the people working on your business, I always thought, like, God, if, I mean, this is back in my day, or maybe let's talk about John Webster. So if I was a client at DDB or BNP rather in the 80s, I would go, okay, so you've got my business, but I insist that John Webster is the creative who works on it. I don't want anyone else from your department. I just want the very best guy. That's it. Can you insist on that? And what's the response if you do?
I've never insisted on that. I'm not sure that clients don't tend to read Campaign magazine as a norm. So I'm not sure that we're particularly aware of who are the kind of the hot creative teams, upcoming creative teams, or which agencies are responsible for specific campaigns. But clients are generally much more aware of which campaigns are coming out of which shops, if that makes sense.
Right.
And it's that, you know, potentially is that kind of thinking that they'll be looking for when they put together a shortlist. But yes, I think it's generally speaking, there will be a discussion, three-way discussion between the client, their procurement manager, and then the finance director at the agency about percentages, etc. You know, that again is detail that can be worked through later. But again, there's probably going to be a balance being struck between percentage of time from a very, very senior member of the creative team, and then that's going to eat into your monthly cost.
Yeah, okay. Can you give us an insight into what actually happens after a pitch? Do you all go off and, you know, separate for a while and come back the next day having digested it, or you're on the train home and you go, well, that was a load of shit, I think number three was far better, or does it differ in each pitch process?
I think it'd be somewhere in between the two. So generally speaking, there would be a cab outside.
Yeah.
That's one tactic for keeping things to time. And you might be, as you say, you might be meeting six agencies over over 2 days. So you do really want to try and keep things to time. Generally speaking, there'll be a bit of discussion in the cab on the way out, or indeed on the way in, around what you're hoping for following a chemistry meeting. And then a bit of discussion around whether things like feedback have been taken on board. But then generally speaking, people will sleep on it and come back. There'll probably be some sort of a quick template, again, just for keeping things as objective as possible. So people will be asked to structure their thought, probably by a procurement manager. And there'll probably be a bit of scoring that goes on.
Right.
But ultimately, there will be somebody somewhere who's got a bigger vote, you know, sort of wearing the trousers, so to speak.
Yeah.
You probably wait for that person to speak first in the taxi. There will be one voice that's definitely louder.
Absolutely. I've been in a few situations with clients where they've had, you know, a team of five clients, and you know who the big dog in the room is, but that person has often gone, okay, let's go around and ask all you guys what you think before I even speak. And I was thinking, oh my God, I wouldn't want to be one of you guys right now, because the client's obviously got something in his head or her head, and should you not chime with that at all? It's obviously like a little, well, quite a big exam of your own ability then and there, but, you know. I guess.
Yeah, because that person with the loudest voice, you probably find that they have a love of comms, but they've been promoted well above the role of dealing with that on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
So whilst they might have the biggest voice in the decision-making process, ultimately they won't be the person that successful team will be dealing with on a day-to-day basis coming through the pitch. I think it's really important that, you know, agency teams kind of recognize that, because there's nothing worse than, a campaign manager, if you like, on the client side, being the front person for a bit of feedback, and then that triggering a call into that marketing director. We don't like this feedback, you know, how about we go out to lunch and discuss it?
Yeah.
You know, that really does undermine the kind of the day-to-day contact. Clients hate that sort of behavior. But ultimately, the feedback may well have come from the top down anyway. Clients will try, I'm sure there are examples where they don't, but will try and consolidate feedback before picking up the phone or firing off an email. But, sometimes it seems that there's a complete misunderstanding of that process from the client's end, particularly if it's, you know, with a bank or something like that, where there might be a legal team involved in the sign off of an ad. So, you know, those sorts of phone calls, you know, from the client services director of the agency into the marketing director on the client side, you know, generally speaking, are really unhelpful and counterproductive ultimately.
Sure. One of the areas that I think we all get into from creative, it doesn't feel like I've heard this quite so much recently, and I think there are kind of it ebbs and flows, but what about research versus gut? Because you've talked about having to explain things to stakeholders, which I guess is easier with some actual Millward Brown documents in your hand. But, you know, we also hear about great ads that were made in spite of failing in research. What's your relationship with research like?
I think it's really important from my perspective. When I'm writing a brief, I want to be working very closely with the research team to help populate that brief, and again try and glean at least the seeds of insight that can kind of germinate when they get in front of the planner. I think generally speaking, if a client insists on researching, you know, a script or what have you, before you're deciding on a kind of a course of direction, it's generally speaking just because the stakes are really high for the client. So yeah, it's not necessarily from lack of bravery, it's potentially just from the risk of getting it wrong. If that makes sense. Have I answered your question?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think that's true. And it's mitigating a potential downside rather than, you know, going, oh great, we know exactly how to, you know, get the color of the person, the main actor's shirt right or something like that.
And I do think in bigger businesses there'll probably be a different team looking after research, but again, it's another set of stakeholders for the client, because they want to make sure that the kind of the monthly brand tracking questionnaire is constantly updated and generating the right sort of data that can be used as part of that evaluation job we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. And have you been involved with either or both of an unexpected disaster or a gigantic, wonderful success? And what are they both like?
That's a really good question. I'm just trying to think, actually. I suppose an unexpected disaster, it depends on the timing, because you do get this knee-jerk reaction where there's massive expectations as soon as a campaign goes live. And if the results don't come in straight away, you do get sales colleagues running it up to you, you know, in the office going, it is a massive disaster. So sometimes that's about holding your nerve, and sometimes that's about going back to a marketing director or maybe even a stakeholder in another market saying, actually, we've underestimated how much we need to spend. And again, that's where you need to work quite collaboratively with the kind of the agency colleagues to again build a case for any incremental investment. Stakeholders are ultimately servicing with a campaign. You know, we're helping people shift product. They tend to have high expectations, as we were saying earlier, and can shout disaster very, very quickly. So sometimes you do need to go back to stakeholders within the business to get approval for additional spend. Or indeed, you might just get together with the agency team and just reflect on why things might be a bit disappointing at this particular stage, and any executional changes or any tweaks in the campaign, anything that can be dialed up or down to ensure the success that everybody's after. In terms of unexpected success, I'm not sure I've ever experienced that, because every campaign I've worked on has always felt like hard graft to get there. So everybody is generally quite confident it's going to work by that stage.
Great. And when it comes to the executional part of it, and you're presented with, I know you said, you know, it's good for an agency to kind of give you mood boards or something like that. When it comes to say, hey, we've got this director or that kind of person, is that something that means much to you, or do you just go, oh, okay? I mean, unless it was a really, really famous one, is that something that you delve into very much, or you trust the agency?
Again, we trust the agency. I mean, I'd want to see the director's reel.
Right.
Because, again, that helps to bring to life the sort of thing that his sort of style or the sort of thing that goes on in his mind. When I'm having discussions in those sort of scenarios, I'm much more conscious about film directors, so talk about a mood and potentially, you know, flip to talking about film directors or do music videos rather than necessarily being too aware of ad directors. Again, I'd you know, be trusting of the kind of the creative team on the account to understand who's best to bring the idea to life.
And so do you find yourself wanting or needing to be up to date with what's going on in culture as well as everything else so that you can properly assess things like that?
Yeah, as I get older, that gets more difficult. I do find myself talking to my children about ads, for example. But yeah, I think it's really important. I think actually, if your campaign is true to the brand, has customer insight at the heart of it, and has the potential to resonate in popular culture with something that's going on, then that's the utopia you're after.
Okay. So I'm sure you're aware of the, I've touched on it a little bit so far, the kind of cliched client agency relationship, and it becomes a little bit them and us, maybe in the pub after the kind of end of the day or something like that. What's the client perspective on the agency, and is there a cliche of that?
Not to my mind. I think clients like to think we're all one big team. Because generally speaking, they've probably got quite an antagonistic relationship with either the sales department or maybe the product department. It kind of depends on the dynamic of that business. I think there are things that do create that perception of them and us. So we talked earlier around, that phone call that takes place between senior agency stakeholder and senior client stakeholder. That's really counterproductive. And
right.
In those scenarios, that triggers kind of them and us sort of discussion. The other thing that can be can trigger that is when sometimes you get people on the account team, they might be fairly, and you're in role, for example, sometimes feel a bit needy, expecting you to be able to attend a meeting with very little notice or indeed ringing you up and then having several other people on a call, catching you out by surprise, you're suddenly on a conference call. That again feels like a kind of a them and us sort of behaviour.
Sure.
But otherwise, it's not necessarily unless that relationship is broken. I wouldn't necessarily say it's kind of a mindset that the clients carry, permanently.
Okay. Is there anything I haven't touched on so far that you'd either like to say? Because I think a lot of the people who listen to this are creatives, although there might be other people in other parts of agencies. Is there anything you've always wanted to kind of say to a whole bunch of us in one go?
Not that we haven't covered so far, I don't think. Just to say, I suppose, career schmoozers, really need to go and work for Harvey Weinstein or something, I don't think many clients like working with agencies that promote people for being charming. They want to work with people that have a passion for the subject matter, are prepared to get passionate about their brand. That's really, really what, or they're looking for, that collaboration in kind of today's complex world, rather than then perhaps a bit of charm and a bit of lunch every other week. Does that make sense?
It does. And has that cliche changed, the client lunch? Do you get wined and dined a bit, and does it feel like it's a kind of part of the thing, or a bit of a false kind of, I don't know, they're there because they have to be? I don't know.
I generally think today that generally only happens where you're trying to resolve a bit of conflict that's come up. In my experience, you don't tend to get that anymore. It's kind of an old world behavior, a bit like the kind of promoting people just because they're charming. It's kind of, that's probably an 80s thing, I would say. So yes, if you're passionate about subjects and you know your brand and your market, you'll get the best from your client, hopefully. Is the reassurance I would give.
Okay, it sounds interesting, because there's like, in speaking to you, there's this balance of, you're aware of the, the cliche of the good old days, and you've sound like you've lived through them to some degree, but you're also aware that things are as they are now, for better or worse, and in some ways, much better. So do you see that the change has been an improved change because it's less of that sort of charming old boys club, take you to lunch, blah, blah, blah situation, which is in some ways is actually a bit patronizing within it?
Yeah, I think the market is continuing to change around us, and I think you've got lots of dynamics going on. You know, people actively downloading ad blocking software, the concerns around ad fraud, you know, big debate in the agency world about diversity, etc. I think all of these things, all of these dynamics, just add up to the fact that time is very, very precious for all of us these days. So yeah, I think that's a positive change, probably that kind of patronizing or schmoozy sort of world is behind us. And I think actually, collaboration is really required so that we can all be as productive as possible in the time we have available to us.
Great. Well, you sound, I'm sure it's going to frustrate a lot of creatives out there. You sound like a grown up, intelligent person with some really good answers to what happened. I mean, I'm sure, you know, people have had bad experiences of bad clients before, and I'm sorry, anyone out there who wanted me to speak to a real kind of arsehole. It sounds like I managed to find one of the good ones, and he's given us lots of really fantastic answers that should hopefully either set your mind at rest or at least give you an insight into what's happening at the other side of the table when you just think, oh, well, you know, why is that decision happening? And I've not really been party to the kind of reasons behind it. So huge thanks. I'm not going to say your name. I've managed not to do it all the way through this thing. So fantastic. And I'll edit this up a little bit and get it out in the next few days. So huge thanks for that.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
Cheers. Bye.
Podcast to watch Christmas.